Well, I don't know if you know that you've got it, but you have got it. You've all got a world view. If you read intellectual books about philosophy and about current trends and this, that and the other, you might be familiar with the word. How did the universe get here? I'm pretty sure that all of us, even the young ones, have some kinds of ideas and thoughts about such things. How did the universe get here? What's the meaning of life? Any religious beliefs? Any direction politically, philosophically or sociologically? You might say, no, I don't even know what he's talking about. I don't know what these words mean. Well, you all think about society and about people and about cultures and the way things should be and the family and school and the education service and this, that and everything else. We all think philosophically about the big things of life. You can't stop it. Even from a very young age, we think along those lines and we start to answer questions about what am I here for? Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? What will make me happy? And that's a big one in our day and in our age. What will make me happy? What will satisfy me? That's your world view, if you like. Answers to the questions of who, what, why, when, where and how. Answers to the questions about life and God and suffering and death and the afterlife are things that we begin sometimes very early on, long before our teenagers, but certainly by the time we are teenagers. Even if we've never stepped foot in a church or held a Bible in our hand, these are the kinds of things that we naturally and instinctively think about. I'm pretty sure if I was to ask you, what are the big main world views in the world in which we live? You would say, well, there are millions of Christians, aren't there? Certainly in Northern Europe, and then there's many Catholics in Southern Europe, and in South America and North America, there are many more, and you might even know a little bit about Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and other Christian cults. There's a Christian worldview. That's how people interpret the world and life and death and suffering and the afterlife. I'm sure you're aware, we prayed, didn't we, about Islam. There are millions of Muslims on the face of the earth, and Buddhists and Hindus as well. I'm pretty sure that most of us will have heard of the word pagans. People who are not Christians, they are not Muslims, they're not Buddhists, they're not Hindus, they're not secular humanists or atheists or agnostics like many people are in our day and in our age, but they worship gods made out of wood and stone and gold and other things. I was thinking the other day, I wonder which book in the Bible would be the most easy to understand for our day and age. The one that really speaks to people in our day and in our generation in this part of the world. I think Proverbs. Proverbs is speaking to us, isn't it, in our age of information. About wisdom. We're bombarded. We've gone through the modern age and even through the postmodern age, and supposedly the intellectual elite call our age the age of information, the age in which you are bombarded by information day in and day out. If you were to try to speak to me when I was a child about the internet and how much information there would be on Wikipedia or Google, even myself, I know I don't look very old, but even in my childhood, I would have said, it's impossible. You couldn't have that much information on one web page. Well, in the midst of this age of information in which we and you live in, Solomon is speaking directly to us. Every book in the Bible speaks directly to us. We've been seeing, haven't we, how Mark is different from the other Gospels and how clearly aware he was of the mindset and the thinking and what was familiar to those living in Rome, as Mark wrote to the Christians that lived in Rome. Well, Solomon is speaking to all of us, and particularly to us, I think, in our day and in our age, where knowledge and information, well, abounds, doesn't it? You just need to, most of us, just pull our phone out of our pocket, touch a few parts of the screen, and you have access to vast amounts of information. You can ask almost any question, put it into Google, and it won't be very long until you find somebody who thinks they've got something of an answer. Well, Solomon here
is pointing us, all peoples, in all places, in all generations, that we must gain wisdom. We must value wisdom, see the excellencies of wisdom, see the promises of wisdom, be tempted by these promises that we've already looked at. We have seen that Christ himself is the wisdom of God, and all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are found in him, and so we can't separate the book from Christ at all. And as Christ warns us, so wisdom warns us again and again. Well, there's not a lot of new content in Proverb 4, but like I said, what is made up for in not very much new content is certainly made up for in fervor. Solomon now is really having another go and really crying out, isn't he, to his sons to make sure that you gain wisdom and you value it. It's almost like the therefores, isn't it, in the New Testament. We have this, don't we? You'll have quite a number of the New Testament books. You'll have the first half or the first chapters or whatever that will teach you who is Jesus, what has Jesus done, what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus, what is God promising to give to us if you follow Jesus, what are the warnings if you reject Jesus and the like, and then you get to a point and it says, therefore, in light of all of this, make sure you listen, follow, submit, and obey. That's what this book is about, isn't it? Therefore, in light of all of the commandments of God, the instruction of God, the wisdom of God, the words of God, in light of all of these things, make sure you listen, hear, believe, trust, love, obey, follow, submit to these things. Our purpose this evening is really going to be to gloss over the proverb, but really in light of verse 23. Keep your heart with all diligence, he says, for out of it spring the issues of life. And we're going to look at that verse in the context of the rest of the proverb. It was a favorite one with the Puritans from a few hundred years ago. Whole books and series of sermons were preached upon it. And I think just about everybody that went to an Anglican church where they had a Puritan minister would have heard it on a number of occasions and would have memorized it. Keep your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the issues of life, is the translation I've memorized. So let's break this up for us then as we look, glossing over the proverb but focusing in on this verse. First and foremost, your heart. What does Solomon and the Bible mean by your heart? Now, he doesn't mean that organ, that vital organ that's within your ribcage that's pumping blood around the rest of your body. He's talking about the real you, your soul, if you like, the core of your being. Again and again we say this, but we need to repeat it, that we are not random, unexplainable, uncreated, undesigned, ultimately futile beings that just happen to have feelings and emotions. We have not randomly come into existence by evolutionary processes. Now that is rammed at us in our generation, isn't it? And the schools and the internet, through your friends often, family, and this, that, and the other. It's rammed into you that the theory of evolution is no longer a theory, but it's an absolute fact. Well, it's not an absolute fact at all. And we challenge you, if it's a real difficulty to you, and if you really can't overcome it, and if you're saying, I can see the value of wisdom, I can see light in the scriptures, I'm drawn towards it, I'm looking at people that are Christians and people that are non-Christians, and the existence of God, it seems to be so obvious, but I just can't get over this supposed theory of evolution. There is more than enough information written by Christian scientists that will just absolutely blow the theory out of the water. We are created in the image of God, designed with a purpose. The heart, according to the Bible, is the part of us that is able to communicate with God. It is able to imitate or copy God, follow him if you like. It is able to enjoy God, experience his love, worship and glorify him. God has set eternity in our hearts, unlike the animal kingdom, and there are irreconcilable differences between us and the animal kingdom. God has set eternity within our hearts.
You can communicate with primates, you can communicate with dogs and this, that and the other, and if we ever manage to communicate with the animal kingdom, any animals in any great degree, and you were able to portray to them the word and the concept of eternity, it would be utterly incapable of any other creature but human beings to even begin to contemplate it. He has set eternity within our hearts. We understand the dimension of time, the concept of past, recent past and distant past, the present, the future, the near future, and way on into the future. We have the capability to grasp that God is outside of time and eternal and can create time, and that we are within it and bring it as we know it to an end and take us into an endless eternal state. This is your heart, the core of your being, what separates you from the animal kingdom. So much so that the Bible doesn't wrestle with us and try to persuade us about the existence of God. Romans chapter 1 tells us very clearly that his eternal nature, his divine power, is so clearly seen and known by us that it renders us without excuse on the day of judgment. The heart is your soul, if you like. We have a word, don't we? It's a common word. Now, people are trying to tell us, no, you don't have a soul. You don't have a heart. You don't have the ability to communicate with God. You don't have the ability to receive from God. You don't have the ability to copy or to follow the example of God. You don't have the ability. Well, we do. The word is the soul, isn't it? The core of our being, including our mind, our conscience, our will, and our emotions. That's what we are as human beings. If you could choose, and if I could choose, which worldview to have, it would be the Christian worldview. You can study the Bible and study, even as unbelievers, if you're an unbeliever here this evening, study the Quran, study the other books, study paganism, study secularism and this, that and everything else that is rammed upon us in our day and in our age. And compare them. And once you've compared them, which one would you like? Which one seems to be the most attractive and appealing? Forget ultimate truth for a second. Just think, what would be the most attractive? Which one would you like to be true? Would you like it to be true that you are nothing more than an animal and your whole existence is completely futile and useless and you're going to die and there's nothing going to happen to you after death? You're going to cease from existence. Humanity will cease from existence and the entirety of this planet and humanity and all of its history is nothing more than futility. Would you like that to be true? Do you want that to be true? Bible gives us the most appealing of all worldviews, telling us that we're created in the image of God to know him, to love him, to serve him, to glorify him, and to enjoy him forever. This is your heart. And we know, and we can know, that this is the ultimate truth. On a number of occasions, people heard Jesus and said things along the lines of, never did a man speak like that man spoke. Or did our hearts not burn within us as we heard him speaking to us on the road? Or as Jesus turned to his disciples and said, do you also want to leave? No, they said. To whom shall we go? You have the words of everlasting life. No one has ever spoken like Jesus. No one ever will speak like Jesus. If there is no God, if the theory of evolution is true, if we are nothing more than over-evolved animals and the entirety of humanity is utterly futile, there couldn't be a person like Jesus. It would be impossible without supernatural divine intervention for there ever to be somebody like Jesus and do the things that Jesus did. This is your heart that you and I all have.
But you can't explain away. You can't just say, oh, it doesn't matter. Jesus doesn't matter. The Bible doesn't matter. God doesn't matter. My heart doesn't matter. I'm not answerable or responsible or accountable to God. You know that you are. And here the proverb tells us, here is your heart. The core part of your being, the thing that makes you different from all of the animals on the face of the earth. The thing that gives you meaning, the thing that gives you value, if you like. The thing that just removes all futility and says that life is a beautiful thing and a thing worth living wisely and properly. Keep your heart, he tells us. Our hearts are like musical instruments that often need retuning again. And he says, and he's talking in Old Covenant language, it's Solomon speaking to his son, and they were all part of the Old Covenant. They didn't understand so much about the need to be born again, and they didn't have all the teaching of the New Testament and this and that and the other. So in a sense, it's a believer speaking to his believing son and telling him, in light of your knowledge of God, in light of your relationship with God, in light of your worshiping God, in light of your wanting to serve God, in light of the day of judgment and your accountability to God, keep your heart. Don't allow your heart to be tossed to and fro with all the latest pop psychology and the prevailing fads of society. Now, Solomon might not be able to put it in that kind of language, a lot of it's modern language, but that's how it would come across to us this evening. As your physical heart needs to be stable and healthy and in a right condition, or it doesn't matter how good the rest of the body is, if your heart is bad and weak, you cannot have good health. Same spiritually. The Bible tells us, and we've seen, haven't we, in the book of Proverbs again and again and again, that the heart is devious and perverse. It's corrupted, isn't it? It's dead and it's blind. And, well, Jeremiah puts it in the best words we could ever have, that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. We're naturally foolish and unwise, as the Proverbs has been telling us, and therefore what do we need? Well, Solomon knows. Solomon knew more than anybody else. It wasn't more money. It wasn't more fame, it wasn't more talents or abilities or anything else. What he really needed was wisdom. And now he speaks to the next generation and he says to them, what you need is not more money, although they were a very, very wealthy family. It's not more talent, although they were an incredibly talented family. It wasn't more fame, although they were a very famous family. What you need is wisdom. Because all the money and all the fame and all of the talent in the world will destroy you and work against you if you have not wisdom. So we're to keep the heart, aren't we? And the whole of the proverb as we read it, and for many of us we've been here over the last few weeks, and again we've had a lot of the same kind of thing. What do you need? Instruction. There it is in verses 1 and 13. What do you need? Understanding. There it is in verse 1, 5 and 7. Insight, discernment, making sense of life. That's what you need. What do you need? Verse 2, good doctrine, we're told. What do you need again in verse 2? Law. We need these things. We need understanding. We need wisdom. We need insight. We need good doctrine. Because we know that the devil is the father of lies and he has spread a whole lot of lies in this very confused world in which you and I live in. We need law. The heart is deceitful, rebellious and perverse and corrupted, and therefore we need law. God commanding us directly as to what and how to do things. We have words like teaching in verses 4 and 11. And hold on to my words. He said we need words, don't we? What a confused individual we would be if we were blind and deaf and mute and somewhat dumb, so that it was almost be impossible for anybody else to communicate with us. Can you even try to imagine what kind of things you would think about if you were in such state? Oh, we can be so very thankful, can't we? Even if we are deaf,
and mute if we've got eyesight. Or if we are blind, at least we can hear, can't we?
Well, we need words. We need wisdom and we need the right path as it's here. We need to avoid the path of the wicked and the way of evil, don't we? That's why Solomon knows wisdom is not irrelevant. Wisdom isn't some kind of plaything that you think about for a little while on a Sunday afternoon maybe and judge whether you're going to follow it or not and embrace it or not and then carry on the rest of the 6 days as if you've never heard the things that you heard here on Sunday. Wisdom is ever so practical, isn't it? On the sea of life, if you like, Solomon is saying you need a compass. Look at all of the words that we've read about guidance and the way and leading and path and walking and steps and running and stumbling and feet and travelling and away. It's all there in the proverb that we've read. There's a true story of a relatively small ship being attacked by a whale. And it done so much damage to the boat that it actually began to sink. So all those that were upon it obviously tried to get all of the lifeboats out. And as they got the lifeboats out, they got everybody into the lifeboats. Two men seemed to be having something of a conversation with one another. And they jumped out the lifeboat and they started swimming towards this sinking vessel again. And they seemed to disappear inside the sinking vessel. And just as it was disappearing, they surfaced back again and came back. A number of people on the lifeboats, what cause would you risk your lives going back? What could there be of such value that you would risk your lives going back into a sinking ship for? The compass. They'd save their lives, but they die in the open sea without a compass. It's the same as us. Even Plato said memorably that man is sailing upon the sea of life, bobbing up and down, if you like, on the sea of life, held up by the best opinions, speculations, ideas of mankind, unless there is some sure word from God. Plato knew we need a compass. We need words, we need commandments, we need insight, we need understanding in the sea and the journey of life. And we are borne up and held, if you like, and kept from drowning by the best opinions, speculations and ideas of mankind unless there is some sure word from God. Where there has been some sure word from God, His name is Jesus, the Word of God. And so the proverb tells us, keep the heart. It's the real you. We all know what it is to try and keep the bodies relatively fit. We all eat, don't we? We all wash our clothes. We all have suitable clothes for the various different seasons. We all try to find ourselves the best education, if you like, and the best mode of transportation, and this, that, and the other. We all love our bodies. What about your heart? The real you. The most valuable part of your existence. Keep the heart, he tells us. Your heart needs a compass. You need instruction. You need direction. Naturally and instinctively, we are all foolish. You can look, so many of you maybe at your parents, or some of us maybe looked at our parents and we thought, well, were they always like that? Were they always a bit grey? And were they always a bit middle-aged? And were they always a bit sensible like this? No, we weren't. We were all young. We were all foolish. We were all wayward. We were all rebellious. We all resisted the gospel. We all resisted what was right and we knew was true. Until Jesus, the wisdom of God, came and captivated our hearts. And now we know that we have a heart and we need to keep the heart. And as the verse goes on, our third point is that we need to keep it with all diligence. It's not easy, is it? And you notice the repetition of the words again and again in the extensive vocabulary that Solomon has. Hear, he says. Give attention, he says, on a few occasions. Do not forsake, he says, three times. Let your heart retain, verse 4. Keep, he says twice. Get, he says twice. Love her, exalt her, embrace her, receive, be led by, take a firm hold of, incline yourself to, he says. Do not let them depart from your eyes, he says. Keep them in the midst of your heart. Put away from you a deceitful mouth and put perverse lips far from you. Let your eyes look straight ahead. Ponder the path of your feet. It's the same thing, isn't it? Just in different language, if you like, from a different angle with slightly different words. Keep the heart with all diligence. The Bible constantly exhorts us to this and to spiritual effort. Although on one side we look at all of the benefits and the blessings of wisdom. All of the fruits of wisdom. Oh, you have it in verse 18, don't you? In beautiful language. But the path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter unto the perfect day. That's lovely language, isn't it? The path of the just, the path of those who have gained wisdom, who value wisdom, who appreciate wisdom, who submit to wisdom and are following Christ and therefore are righteous, their path, it shines brighter and brighter unto the perfect day. And we read these promises and these blessings and we're very thankful for them. But if we're really to shine brighter and brighter and to grow spiritually, if you like, and to be going in the right direction, not looking to the right or to the left or slowing down, we're going to need to keep the heart with all diligence. And that's the constant exhortation of the scriptures, isn't it? To watch and pray so you don't fall into temptation. To work out your salvation with fear and with trembling. To put off the old man and to put on the new. To put to death the deeds of the flesh. To lay aside every hindrance and the sin that so easily ensnares us. To take up your cross daily and follow him or resist the devil as he prowls around steadfast in the faith. The way of wisdom is a blessed way that leads to heaven itself, we're reminded. But it's a narrow and often a difficult way. As Peter puts it, and besides this, give all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to your virtue knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. For if these things be in you and abound, you will neither be useless nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Wisdom, godliness, sanctification, Christ-likeness, righteousness, holiness, fruitfulness, whichever word you want to use to basically describe the same thing, don't come naturally, automatically, or easily. They need to be diligently fought for and worked for, and that's why we're constantly exhorted, aren't we, to strive, to reach, and to grasp for these things. God is good. God is patient. God is generous. God is kind. God is mindful that we are but dust. But also, he brings us to himself, whether it's in a Christian family or from a non-Christian family, whether it's from far away, from far into darkness. You can feel that you're plummeting down even into that bottomless pit yourself, maybe, and he lifts us up, doesn't he? And he's kind to us and he's good to us. And he reveals himself to us. And he doesn't expect an awful lot from us at the very beginning. Like we don't expect an awful lot from our infant children. As they grow and get closer to their teenage years and their teenage years and then they move on further, we do expect more from them. And as life, sadly, I have to say this, gets harder, it doesn't get easier. It gets harder the older you get, the more likely you are to be sick. The older you are, the more time you spend on the road, the more likely you are to have an accident. The older you are, the more likely you are to be bereaved of dearly beloved ones. So we need to keep heart with all diligence. For out of it spring the issues of life. We often try to respray the outside of a car, don't we? I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about here. You've got a car and it's full of rust and this, that and the other, and you sand it down or whatever and you send it for a respray. Well, there's absolutely no point in doing that if there is no engine or the engine is completely broken. I often find myself with the cynical sense of humour that I have in Africa, where quite a few people die pretty regularly and it's all very out in the open and there's open coffins, and if they know there's a preacher from England around, I get invited to multiple different funerals all the time when I'm out in Tanzania, and it somewhat humorizes me at how much makeup they put on a corpse. It's a corpse. You can't make it up. It's dead. It's going into the ground and it's going to be corrupted. But this is so often what we do in our day and in our age, isn't it? In an age where we are morally falling apart, as we are experiencing a huge shift, aren't we, in our culture and in our society. And what amazes me is how patient God is and good God is. That He gave to us very liberally and generously in many, many ways. And why doesn't He snatch and take these great blessings away from us? Because He's long-suffering. But we're seeing the downward spiral, aren't we? And the evidence is clear for us to see. I don't need to remind you of the statistics of divorce or unwanted teenage pregnancies or drug addiction or alcoholism or violence or crime and the prison system and this, that and the other. Morally, we are falling apart and therefore suffering the consequences of this. It's out of the heart that spring the issues of life. And so we can get a bit of religion, if you like. We can get a bit of politics, if you like. We can get a bit of do good, if you like. We can get a bit of this, that, and the other. But it's like putting makeup on a corpse or respraying a car that's engine is completely broken. C.H. Spurgeon, when he was preaching on the same text, he used the illustration of poisonous waters being pumped into a town or a city, and the local water authorities thinking, what on earth can we do about these poisonous waters being pumped into the city's homes? Well, they changed the taps. They didn't work. They thought, all right then, we won't change the taps, we'll change the pipes. But it didn't work. The source of the poison was in the reservoir, so changing the pipes and the taps isn't going to do any good whatsoever. It's the same morally and spiritually. Jesus teaches us very clearly that all issues come out of the heart, don't they? For within, he says, from out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. A good man, Jesus goes on, the good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth that which is evil. For of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. As you go through the rest of the proverb, and we're glossing over all the rest, focusing in on verse 23, you can't but notice in verse 24 he talks about the deceitful mouth. And then let your eyes look straight ahead. Ponder the path of your feet. But the eyes and the lips and the feet, just follow the heart. What is in the heart is reflected in the words, the actions, the conduct and the behavior, the mouth, the hands, the feet, the wallet, your time, reflect what's in your heart. So God goes straight for the heart, the wellspring, the mainspring of a watch, if you like, and says, that's what needs to be dealt with. It's your attitude, it's your motives, it's your desires, it's your feelings that need to be transformed. It's what you really love. It's what you really enjoy. It's what you really want, isn't it, that will determine your outward character. to the exhortation for us here. As I said in the Proverb 4 here, there's not much new content, but there is this great verse that many, many people in generations past have memorized and made much of. It reminds us that we have a heart, and we need to keep the heart. The heart won't naturally and instinctively go in the right direction of wisdom and receive all of the fruits and the blessings and the promises of God towards those that are wise. And so it needs to be kept. And well, because the situation is so disastrous and the heart is so fallen, it doesn't just need to be kept, but kept diligently. And the rest of the psalm, as we open up from the verse, reminds us once again of the results of a heart that is kept diligently. In verse 4, he tells us, doesn't he? Keep my commands and live. Now, I don't know about you, but I can see life outside of Christ as surviving, existing, continuing on. Sometimes, if everything's going well, you could even dare to use the word somewhat thriving. But Jesus says, I've come that you may have life, and life in all of its fullness. A quality of life in God residing and indwelling and in filling and in guiding and leading your heart, so that you know the security of God's love, you know the joy and the happiness somewhat of heaven itself in various degrees at various times, and you can know an actual usefulness. That's a word, isn't it, that strikes us particularly as we leave our teenage years maybe and enter into adult life, and certainly as we're entering into our middle ages, we have a desire to be useful. All of the fun and the games and this, that and everything else of your teenage years begin to have to be left behind, and being useful, actually achieving and accomplishing something, is set within us. Wisdom tells us you will have life. God will give you this abundant life, the life of His Son, the life of His Spirit, the very life of heaven itself, and you will know all manner of things as He goes on. And He tells us that wisdom will preserve you. It will spare you. It will protect you. Anxiety and fear is almost an epidemic, isn't it? Amongst the elderly in our day and in our age. But wisdom says, no, it will preserve you, it will keep you. You need not be afraid or anxious, you will be secure and safe in the hands of wisdom itself. It will keep you, verse 6. It will promote you, verse 8. It will bring you honor. Better a reputation of godliness than all fame and popularity, Solomon is saying. Although he was a very big public figure as the king of Israel and the son of David, better a reputation of godliness than all of the fame and reputation that money and power and authority could ever bring, he tells us. It'll place on your head an ornament of grace. It will crown you with glory. Now, in New Testament language, as Paul is dying, he says, I've run the race, I've kept the faith, and now is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, and not only for me, but for all those who have loved His appearing. James talks about a crown of life, or Peter talks about a crown of glory that will not fade away. They're talking about the life to come. That outside of Christ, there is shame and condemnation, outer darkness, where the worm is never dies and the fire is never quenched, and it's just an endless, never ceasing falling downward, spiraling deeper into the darkness of the bottomless pit. For those that embrace Christ and wisdom, for those who understand that they're created in the image of God and have a heart and want to keep it and keep it diligently, the results of wisdom are quite, quite astounding. Wisdom will crown you eternally with glory. It will give you many years on earth. Your steps will not be hindered. It will keep you from stumbling and give you stability as you build your life upon the rock, Christ Jesus. It will even be your life, we're told in verse 13. Take firm hold of this instruction. Do not let go. Keep her, for she is your life. And we know the wiser we become, the more we keep our hearts diligently. Christ, who is our life, the apostle says. It will be life and health to your soul, we are told. God's wisdom isn't something just to take up an hour or two on a Sunday morning or a Sunday evening, is it? At all, it is our world view. It's the way we interpret everything, isn't it? How we answer all the questions of life, whether religious, politically, philosophically, socially, we take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, who is our life. You see, Solomon and God really, really want to coin the modern phrase, your best life now. And these are not mere empty platitudes like we hear from the pop psychologists and the seeker-sensitive church and the media and this, that and everybody else. The life gurus or the life coaches that seem to abound with this lost generation that doesn't know where to turn for truth and reality. The seeker-sensitive church will offer you joy, peace, success and prosperity. Pop psychology that dominates our education system and our media will offer you nothing really. It will sometimes take some biblical principles of morality, totally void of any real reasons for doing it, and totally void of God and reality. But God offers us wisdom, godliness, righteousness, Christ-likeness, holiness. As God points us to what we were originally created and intended to be and to be like, which will bless us. Not some notional assent to some simple statements that you pay some money for that you hear in some churches. But we've got a radical problem. I've got a radical problem. You've got a radical problem. Everybody that has or ever will live has a radical problem. And it's our hearts. And therefore, the remedy is a radical one. That you would keep it with all diligence, knowing that from it flow the issues of life. Jesus says, doesn't he? That the way to life, the way to wisdom, it's a narrow gate. You must strive to enter through it. A narrow and a difficult path. Don't turn to the left or to the right, but as Solomon puts it, we keep the heart with all diligence, knowing that from it flow the issues of life. Here you sit this evening. Some of you are old, some of you are young. Some of you have been Christians for many years, some of you have recently been converted and baptized. Some of you are tall, some of you are short like me. Some of you are male, some of you are female. Some of you are fat, some of you are thin, some of you are somewhere in the middle like me. And there you sit. But God speaks not to our bodies, but to our hearts this evening. Are you keeping your heart with all diligence? Knowing that from your heart will come your words, from your heart will come your actions, from your heart will come how you treat your money, from your heart will come what you do with your life. And it's what comes from your heart and what is in your heart that God knows and will judge you for. Solomon cries out to us, don't be a fool. Keep the heart with all diligence. For from it flow the issues of life. Amen.